Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Superbeats. I personally take Superbeats when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Superbeats gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at intelligentbeats.com. That's intelligentbeats.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today, we're going to continue in our series of clinical focus podcasts, wherein I deal with one or another topic in medicine, health, nutrition, by focusing on what I would term medical epic fails. And by that, I mean things that we've done in medicine that now, under the light of scrutiny, appear to be absurd, wrong, or potentially harmful. Now, there are many, many of these, and I wrote an article about this that appeared in our newsletter that you can read. It was in two parts, and I'm going to go over some of these medical fails in detail. Of course, over the history of medicine, there have been innumerable medical fails. We can think back to leeches, bloodletting, the use of mercury for syphilis. They actually used mercury, a potent toxin, to kill syphilis. Ultimately, it wasn't clear whether it was the syphilis or the mercury that was making people go mad in the 18th century and the 19th century. Other things in more recent times, x-rays for acne. I actually see some patients from time to time, older patients, who as adolescents were taken by their parents to fancy Park Avenue doctors because they had a little acne, and they received miracle treatments in the 1950s. X-rays were thought to be a very good way to eradicate skin bacteria and cure acne, unfortunately causing cancers of the salivary glands, cancers of the thyroid, skin cancers, and so on. Radical mastectomies. A guy named Halsted, early in the 20th century, came up with the idea that the more breast tissue you could cut out, the better the chances were of survival for women with breast cancer. So they had horrible, very deforming surgeries that were just, you know, you just cast your eyes on pictures of this with revulsion. Then it was found out only many decades later that these radical surgeries were unwarranted, that they did not improve survival, they increased misery. Certainly, they made a lot of women feel terrible about their bodies. Then, of course, there was thalidomide, which caused a horrible limb deformities. It was just a medication used to treat nausea of pregnancy, and with terrible consequences. So, you know, I could go on and on. Medicine changes very fast. So there's a little aphorism that we learned during medical school to humble us because it was said that within 10 years of graduating medical school, half of what a young doctor learns will be proven obsolete. Well, I've been out of medical school for over 30 years, so you can imagine. I guess that means that one-eighth of what I learned is correct, and seven-eighths has been proven obsolete. Probably not quite that bad, but at least that gives us a sort of a position of humility when we look at some of the things that are the medical verities of today, some of the surgeries that are recommended, some of the medications that we think are just absolutely mandatory. Perhaps in 20 or 30 years, we're going to say, gee, how could we have been so barbarous as to do some of these things. So in this Clinical Focus podcast, I'm going to go through a few of these. And as you listen, you may find that you or a loved one have been engaged in some of these medical follies. Some of them have only been proven quite recently, so it's quite likely that you may have undergone one of these medical procedures or taken one of these medications absolutely unnecessarily and also possibly to your great detriment. So I'll start with something that is quite close to home for me personally, leg braces for pigeon-toed children. That's a great example of medical overkill. And if any of you remember the movie Forrest Gump, you remember a scene in which as a child, he's fitted with these very cumbersome leg braces. And he's got to walk around with a stiff-legged gait because he's wearing these corrective leg braces. And when I saw that, literally tears welled up in my eyes because I was born in 1952 and this was still in vogue. And I have very little recollection of this, but my parents told me that this is something that they did, is that when I started walking, I had kind of like a funny pigeon-toed gait, and an overzealous doctor said, oh, you know, your child needs leg braces. And my parents being very, very upscale and very conscientious, they said, of course, let's put him in leg braces. And, you know, this can do incalculable psychological damage to a young child. You saw it in Forrest Gump. And the cool thing about Forrest Gump is that there was real redemption because at some point he said, let me get rid of these god-awful things. He literally cast them off one day and realized that he could walk quite well without them. And in fact, not only could he walk, but he became a long-distance runner. He shed his knee braces, and he, like me, became a long-distance runner. And in fact, now looking back on this, they've done studies. Pediatricians now agree this is a completely unsupported medical fad. You know, they're medical fads, just like they're fads in fashions. You know, we don't wear bell bottoms anymore. I guess, well, who knows? Maybe bell bottoms are making a comeback on the spring runway this season as a retro fashion statement. But they're just as in fashion, there are medical fads, you know, like fins on cars. And these things come and go. And unfortunately, sometimes they're embraced before the science is properly done. And that's an example of that. Studies now show that most kids naturally outgrow their early gait problems. And they even, many of the kids who were labeled as having pigeon toes or gait problems go on to become outstanding athletes. It's actually thought that a slightly pigeon-toed gait may make you a better runner without harsh intervention. You can go on to be fine. All right, another, here's one that I think a lot of people have been subject to, and that is number two candidate, and I've got 10 of these. Number two candidate for a medical epic fail is steroid injections for a condition called spinal stenosis. Now, spinal stenosis is very common because people lose mobility as they get older. And we have a lot of trouble with spinal stenosis in medicine. People sometimes call my show and say, what do I do about spinal stenosis? And it's tough to treat once it's developed. Once you have developed an impingement of your spinal cord, causing weakness in your legs and sometimes pain, this is in contradistinction to claudication. Claudication is the more you walk, the more pain you have. Here, you walk it off. You may wake up with the pain, but after you mobilize yourself a little bit, you mobilize the spine, and there's less pain. But there's often a lot of weakness, balance problems associated with spinal stenosis. It's a terrible problem because literally the spinal cord and the vertebrae encroach upon the spinal column. That's one of the reasons why people should engage in a program of lifelong flexibility and yoga, take anti-inflammatory nutrients, eat an anti-inflammatory diet. It's more, I think, about prevention than reversal. Surgery for that is very iffy, you know, to, quote, release the spinal cord. There's a lot of controversy about surgery. But one of the things that's a mainstay of treatment for this is a steroid injection. Well, you know, it's called an epidural injection. Now, you're familiar with the term of epidural if you're younger, especially if you're a woman. You know that they do epidurals for a spinal anesthesia during childbirth. They stick a needle in your spinal cord and they inject a temporary anesthetic in there, and you don't really feel as much in the way of birth pain. But when they treat spinal stenosis, they put a steroid in there. The reason is the steroid is supposed to reduce swelling and keep the pressure off the spinal cord. Well, what they discovered, you know, finally, you know, said, well, this makes a lot of sense. Let's, you know, probably this has been done millions of times, and people get repeated injections. Studies show that this does not actually make a difference in terms of the ultimate outcome. Just a shot of lidocaine, it was a local anesthetic, the same kind of thing that you get in a dentist's office, can relieve pain temporarily in spinal stenosis. Doesn't do much good, but you know, a lot of times when you get a procedure, there's a strong placebo effect. People walk away saying, hey, thank you, doctor, you know, it's made a difference for a while. Then you know, eventually you have more pain, you come back, you get another steroid injection. The problem with these steroid injections was underlined recently because they had a batch of contaminated steroids that were injected into the spinal cords of patients with spinal stenosis and back pain. And lo and behold, these people developed the most fulminant, resistant, difficult to treat fungal infections. Some of them died. Others that didn't die, maybe they wished they had died because they were miserable, debilitated. And this happened to scores of patients. The lab has since been closed down. This has resulted in more stringent regulations for compounding pharmacies, which unfortunately has impacted some of the great compounding pharmacies that were innocent of these types of contamination episodes and that supply us with some of the important ingredients that we use for patients, that custom compound vitamins and natural hormones. But anyway, this steroid injection proved to be very hazardous because it goes directly into the spinal cord. That goes into your central nervous system. It can actually travel up into your brain. Very, very serious problem if it's contaminated. Of course, the vast majority of these injections are sterile, but even steroids administered correctly, when they're sterile, they can increase your risk for osteoporosis, for diabetes. They can create psychological problems, mental problems, on and on it goes. There's sometimes a very serious consequences. Plus, if you have too many steroid injections, ultimately that can damage the bone surrounding where the steroid injection is given. It can actually cause localized bone thinning, and that's not good. So this is a common practice, steroid injections for spinal stenosis. Hopefully they're heeding the results of this study, and less and less people will be exposed to this medical epic fail. But it's a real tragedy. All right, number three. This is a real popular thing, which is arthroscopic surgery for knee osteoarthritis. So there's lots and lots of people with knee problems, especially as they get older. And often it's due to osteoarthritis, which is an inflammatory condition of the knee that sometimes occurs because of wear and tear. But actually, many studies suggest that runners are actually less likely to get knee osteoarthritis than sedentary individuals. So it's not about that. I mean, of course, you do have a lot of running injuries. You can get post-injury inflammation, which is chronic, and that can lead to osteoarthritis. But osteoarthritis is an inflammatory condition that is related to overweight. It's related to a pro-inflammatory diet. It is certainly related to aging. And inherently, you know, probably a majority of people have some degree of osteoarthritis as they age because aging is a sort of an inflammatory condition. But doing arthroscopic surgery is popular. You go in there and they say, well, we're going to clean out your knee. We don't even have to, you know, we're not going to replace your knee. We're not going to put in a prosthetic. We're just going to put a little tiny hole in there. We'll go in with a scope and then we'll kind of roto-rooter your meniscus, which is the cushioning cartilage between the upper part of your leg and the lower part of your leg where they meet at the knee, and just clean that out and you'll feel better. Well, this surgery was pioneered in athletes who have tears, and there is a rationale for it. If you have a tear, if you have a you know, median collateral ligament or ACL tear, you can get a repair through arthroscopic surgery. It's perfectly fine, and it was pioneered in the 80s, 90s in athletes. But then it became generalized to anybody with a knee problem would get arthroscopic surgery. Well, according to studies, they show that if you have osteoarthritis, not a knee injury, because injuries can be repaired. But if you just have generalized osteoarthritis, they did a study where they did sham surgery. Because, you know, anytime you go into the hospital and they do a procedure, they put a bandage around your leg, you do physical therapy, most of the time you're going to feel better. And in fact, that's what they did. They did sham surgery. In other words, they put a little hole in the knee, but they didn't actually do the arthroscopic surgery. They had the people in both groups do physical therapy, and they found that the results were virtually identical, whether they had the actual arthroscopic surgery or the sham surgery. You know, 30-40% of people got relief, at least temporarily, from their arthroscopic surgery or their sham surgery, in effect, a placebo surgery. Because a true placebo, you know, when you take a pill, it's easy to do a double-blind placebo-controlled study. Some people get sugar pills and some people get active ingredients. When you do a study of surgery, you actually have to do some kind of procedure, even if it's a sham procedure, to see if it's actually going to make a difference. So, you know, what irks me is that there's so many orthopedists out there and people in the medical community who are very quick to downplay the documented benefits of things like glucosamine chondroitin, which, by the way, in a recent study was found to be as effective as Celebrex, a popular non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, in the treatment of knee pain. And they put down fish oil, and they put down curcumin, and they said, well, supplements don't work. But they're willing to do an unscientific, poorly documented procedure on patients for profit, you know, with little prospect that it's better than some kind of placebo or sham procedure. So I think that's certainly, there's an element of hypocrisy in that. And that's why, you know, by the way, this, some people say, well, what about knee replacement? That's a different thing. You know, if your knee is so shot that it's not going to respond to glucosamine, curcumin, fish oil, any of these natural interventions, then, you know, I urge you to get knee replacement. I think knee replacement gives people a new lease on life. And some of the new devices are really sturdy, last a long time. People become active again. That's very important to, you know, not be in constant pain and not be limited in your physical activity. But arthroscopic surgery recently got very poor marks in terms of treatment for a common knee problem, which is osteoarthritis. And there's just, you know, a whole list of things. Niacinamide as well, in studies, has been proven helpful. SAMe for some patients suffering from knee pain. Certainly, even good physical therapy can help get people out of trouble. So think before you leap when it comes to arthroscopic surgery. Okay, another one, number four, aspirin for heart disease prevention. Now, let me set the stage for you. In the 80s, when I began my medical career, they had this thing called baby aspirin. Now, baby aspirin is a classic oxymoron. Oxymoron means the two things, like an honest politician or a virtuous prostitute. Baby aspirin, those two words should not be juxtaposed because babies should not receive aspirin, it turns out. When a baby gets a fever and you really want to treat it, you give them Tylenol. Not that Tylenol is perfect or great. It's got side effects too. But aspirin can be devastating because it's been discovered it causes a condition called Reye syndrome. So all this baby aspirin that piled up, they couldn't give it to anyone anymore. But the industry had an answer to that. They came up with a notion that virtually all adults should take aspirin to prevent a heart attack. Now, variously, they said, well, anybody over 40, 45, 50, 60, pick a number, should take aspirin just for prevention. And a lot of people went for it. And a lot of doctors said, hey, you might as well take aspirin. Well, I'm fine. Well, go ahead and take aspirin, because who knows? You know, you're older. You could get a heart attack or a stroke. Statistically, older people do get them. And so they said, well, just take an aspirin. Well, it turns out, and this, again, you know, scientific studies were performed. And what they found was that, and there's a big study done in Japan with thousands of people, they found that there was very little to justify aspirin in, quote, healthy people. Now, healthy person means a person who's not had a heart attack, a stroke, or bypass surgery, or valve replacement, or atrial fibrillation. I mean, there are various conditions where aspirin does pay off. If you've had a stent, for example, they want you on aspirin, possibly along with Plavix, to thin your blood because stents are sticky and platelets can stick to stents. So that, you know, there is a reason there for aspirin as a targeted blood thinner in someone who has definite heart disease. But even someone who said, you know, if you have a little, you know, 10% carotid plaque, or if you have a EBT heart scan and it shows a calcium score of 50 or something, okay, you got a little bit of plaque, but doesn't mean you're like on the road to getting a heart attack. You're asymptomatic. And taking aspirin confers very little protection, but it increases your risk for gastrointestinal bleeding. And sometimes even if you don't have a full bleeding ulcer, we might see low iron sometimes in older patients who take an aspirin every day. They're not clearly having major bleeds, but they're gradually seeping iron or blood from their gastrointestinal tract because of the cumulative effects of aspirin. Or another bigger risk is there are two types of strokes. One is prevented by aspirin, but another can be caused by aspirin. It's called a hemorrhagic stroke when you have too much in the way of anticoagulation. You can actually get a brain bleed, which is devastating. So aspirin for heart disease prevention. Here's now, in light of this, this is what the Food and Drug Administration says. This is the FDA issuing a specific warning. They say, quote, scientific data do not support the use of aspirin as a preventive medication by people who have not had a heart attack, stroke, or cardiovascular problems. How about that? I mean, how many years have you been told, take an aspirin, take an aspirin, take an aspirin, take an aspirin? And now, in the light of scientific scrutiny, it turns out that that was an epic fail. So, meanwhile, if you want to get some slight blood thinning effect without the risk of bleeding, you can take some omega-3 fish oil, EPA, DHA. You can take some additional vitamin E, particularly the gamma-tocopherol-rich vitamin E. It has a slight blood thinning effect. That's why sometimes they don't want you to take it before major surgery. Or chiolic aged garlic extract, which not only has slight blood thinning effects, but actually reduces inflammation in the arteries, can slightly lower cholesterol, has antioxidant effects. I mean, there's so many natural interventions that are preferable to taking aspirin. And so these are some of the top medical fallacies that you might be subject to. I'll share another one with you, which is, you've heard this again and again, and I've inveighed against it in many of my broadcasts and podcasts, the notion that you should just eat a healthy diet and skip your supplements. That's a canard that still gets a lot of play in the media and also in doctor's offices. And for example, I just saw a patient who underwent a very, very elaborate and expensive executive checkup at a major hospital here in New York, very fancy. This is an upscale patient who can afford the best medical care, and she had every single scan test imaginable, and they concluded basically that she was fine, and they said, oh, by the way, you know, stop taking your vitamins because there's no evidence that vitamins are beneficial. Now, this is, you know, after a very intensive medical workup at a very major medical institution, and this reflects the prejudice against taking vitamins. There's such a high percentage of Americans that have documented levels of key B vitamins. Many people who have a mutation, the MTHFR mutation, might benefit from higher doses of methylating B vitamins like methyl B12, methylfolate, vitamin B6. Many people, magnesium deficient, I think, depending on which statistics you look at, only 20% of Americans have adequate magnesium intake. Vitamin D deficiency is rampant, especially in the winter and among some populations, especially, you know, individuals with darker skin, it's harder for them to make vitamin D. And lots of people don't eat any fish. They don't get any omega-3 fatty acids, so supplementing with omega-3 would be very desirable for them. And yet, there's so many messages that we get via our medical system and via the media that vitamins and supplements don't bother because just eat, they keep repeating this old song, just eat a healthy diet. Well, yeah, I have no problem with that. Just eat a healthy diet. But that is not a substitute for taking vitamins and supplements. And oh, by the way, people with specific medical conditions, we can actually use targeted supplementation to alleviate their medical conditions, many psychiatric conditions, neurological conditions, gastrointestinal conditions, you name it. These are conditions, autoimmune conditions. They respond very well to targeted supplementation. So there, you know, there we have the first five out of my 10 offerings for medical epic fails. Stay tuned because in part two, we'll continue our discussion. We'll reel off five more medical epic fails that it's very likely that you or a loved one may have succumbed to at one time and that you should be wary of. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.